Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyard, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. In a moment, I'll introduce a well-known atheist. But first, two news updates. Why won't Governor Blagojevich resign? The media is beside themselves with Blagojevich holding on to his office in Illinois. Well, you heard it here first at BEL. Apparently, he's told the lieutenant governor, Blagojevich has told Pat Quinn, that he's going to have to come up with something significant before Blagojevich resigns, saying something to the tune of, if you think you're going to walk into this office with nothing in your hand, you're nuts. This office is worth a fortune, so put up or forget it. And separately, on Tuesday, we reported a temperature of minus 81 degrees in Siberia while I was interviewing the author of It's the S-U-N, Not Your SUV, John Zerkowski, who opposes the global warming hype along with 30,000 U.S. scientists who signed a petition against the global warming scare. And we reported that America can expect cold and snow due to the minus 81 degrees forecast for Siberia. And now, 2 days later, while there's much more cold coming from the Arctic through next week, it's already snowing in Houston earlier in the season than it has in 62 years. And there's a lot of snow on the ground, even in New Orleans, of all places. Now to our segment on atheism. Here at Bob Enyard Live, we've debated a few atheists, including ABC's Reginald Finley. Remember him, called the infidel guy from ABC's Wife Swap program. And two atheists from Theology Online. One goes by the name Fool, and the other is a psychologist named Zaketh. Then there's the atheist author of the book God.com, John Henderson. Do you remember all these debates? And Michael Shermer, an editor with Scientific American, and I think he's with the Skeptic Society. Now comes atheist Dan Barker. You know the story of the atheist plaque in Seattle set up nearby the Christian nativity scene at the Capitol? Well, Dan Barker has been widely quoted regarding that story since he's one of the leaders of FFRF, Freedom From Religion Foundation. When Dan Barker was a teenager, I got this from his website, he was involved with the ministry of Catherine Coleman, and she was one of the so-called faith healers who are routinely exposed as frauds by us here at Bob Enyard Live. We point out that, you know, the faith healers on TV are frauds, that they can't heal an ingrown toenail, let alone cancer. Well, Dan was on Fox News last weekend. So, Dan Barker, thanks for coming on Bob Enyard Live.
Oh, hi, Bob. Thanks for the invitation.
Sure thing. So, Dan, I think my producer, Ray Graybar, asked if we could, rather than talk about the plaque, everybody's been talking about that, if we could actually talk about the issue of atheism versus theism.
Well, that's fine, yeah.
All right. So I have some questions for you. Perhaps we could start like that.
Yes. And, you know, my newest book is called Godless, How an Evangelical Preacher Became One of America's Leading Atheists. So your listeners ought to know that I was a true believer. I loved my Christian life. And I preached it and did not want to give it up. I thought it was wonderful. But I learned... painfully, I learned that the Christianity is false, and that's, I had to reject it on intellectual grounds.
All right, and certainly we shouldn't believe in anything that's not true, right? That's not only foolish, but it could be destructive. Christianity should be falsifiable. For example, in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul said, if Christ is not risen, then we are fools of all men. Our faith is void.
Yeah, he said, if Christ be not risen from the dead, then our faith is in vain. Yeah.
Right, so if Christ did not rise from the dead, if there is no God, if he didn't create us, then we should reject Christianity, as the Apostle Paul indicated. A Christian who's fearful and doesn't have a foundation for his faith, he might be afraid to acknowledge even that.
Yeah.
But the Apostle Paul wasn't afraid. He said, hey, we need to believe the truth. So, Dan Barker, you've become convinced that there is no God. And I know that traditionally it's hard to prove a negative. Like some atheists will point out, if God is on a star a billion light years away, how could I prove atheism? And so I will stipulate for you that we don't have to talk about a God who's hiding somewhere in the far reaches of the universe. All right? Our discussion could be what we could see and know right here, right now, between you and me and the audience.
Well, you're right. I think you're a little smarter than a lot of Christians I debate who see it more black and white than that. It's, you know, most of us atheists reject belief in God for the same reasons we reject belief in leprechauns. I mean, I could not prove to you 100% that there are no leprechauns, yet neither of us believe in leprechauns. We go with the claim there are no leprechauns, although we can't philosophically nail it. I don't know if there's any truth that you could nail shut with 100%.
Well, that's the first question I wanted to ask. Is there truth? Is there truth? I know a lot of atheists say there is no truth.
Well, yes and no. If you have truth with a capital T, no. But truth with a lowercase t, which is really just a label for a concept. And of course, you know, philosophers have three or four different ways of defining truth. But if you want me to answer it my own way,
well,
yes, there is truth.
Okay, well, let's skip to truth with a capital T. Are there things that are absolutely true? Absolutely true. Truth being a statement of reality. So some statements that are absolutely, objectively valid true.
If truth is defined as a correspondence between a term within a statement and the real world and reality, then yes. But truth is not a thing, a capital T thing.
Well, of course not, right?
Okay,
we use a million words to describe things.
Exactly. But if we define, as I do, and not all atheists and not all believers even agree with each other on that, but as I define truth, the correspondence theory of truth, and in addition to that, of course, the coherence theory of truth strengthens the likelihood of a statement. But if I say I have a blue pen on my desk, and I look on my desk, and there is a blue pen, and I touch it, and I feel it, and by all basic measures of perception and understanding, I see it's there, then the statement that there is a blue pen on my desk is a true statement.
But of course, Dan, but some people could easily be deceived. People perceive things that are not real all the time, so some atheists take refuge in that, and so they hesitate, they qualify to say that there's absolute truth, and they say based on our perceptions, we perceive, but I'd like to know if you could give an unequivocal statement that, yes, truth exists.
Well, as I said before, truth is not a noun.
Well, you know, gravity is not a thing that you put in a test tube.
Well, I'll repeat what I said earlier.
But yet gravity describes some real aspect of the universe.
I'll repeat what I said earlier then. Yeah. Assuming that we can trust the reliability of our senses and experiential knowledge, that may be a false assumption, but assuming that we can and we use that to establish a correspondence between reality and terms within a statement, then yes, you can say that there are statements that
okay.
are true or false.
All right, and Dan Barker, you did just qualify, so let me go further. Quite often, people see visions. They see things that are not there. And so quite often, you can't rely on your senses, quite often. And people witness an accident and give three completely different accounts of what happened. So another thing, I went into a philosophy class at a college and videotaped it. We have a DVD called Get Out of the Matrix, and the teacher was an atheist, and she had a handout with a conclusion of something you just referred to about our senses. You know, we have five senses, and some people have argued that the only real knowledge comes through your five senses. Have you ever heard that concept?
Yeah, empiricism. Yeah, just direct.
And do you think that's a valid concept or no? Because I think it's very much invalid. That the only true knowledge comes through your five senses.
Well, no, but knowledge of what I said before is the only thing that can be true or false is a statement, right? A statement has terms within it, and if those terms have a reference that have a correspondence to reality, then we can talk about within that context whether that statement is true or false. I mean, the whole thing might be an illusion, and we're all being fooled by something. But within our human experience and our basic senses, we can be pretty confident that there are as much as, especially through peer review and through objective, independent, double-blind studies of other confirmations, we can increase the likelihood of a statement being true or false. So I guess I'm not sure what you're getting at. I don't know any scientist who would say anything is 100% confident, but we go with it.
For example, the curator of Denver's Museum of Natural History, Kirk Johnson, Dr. Kirk Johnson, he and I were having a debate about truth because I pointed out an exhibit that I thought was clearly not true, overstated, and he asked the Pontius Pilate type question, what is truth? And I said, Kirk, do you agree that truth exists? Can you assert that some things could be absolutely true? And being an atheist, he refused to assert that. And so if someone cannot give an unqualified statement that, yes, some things are absolutely true, then why debate? Why listen to their opinion? I mean, you're asserting that there is no God. That's either true or not. That's either true or not. So there must be a truth that we're seeking after.
We may as well not even have any dialogue or conversation at all, because that word truth can be defined however you want it to.
Well, I'm defining it as a statement of reality, and I'm not saying I know the truth. I'm saying that we have to have some common ground that we could agree. Let's say I provided you with sufficient evidence that God exists, and you came back 3 hours later and said, well, I don't even know if I exist. So I don't know if anything could be true.
I wouldn't go that far. If you provided me good evidence that God exists, I would change my mind and say you were right and I was wrong.
Okay, well, let me suggest to you that you have a bit of an a priori bias shown by your hesitancy to acknowledge that some things are absolutely true.
Yeah, but I did answer that as clearly as possible.
Well, no, you said based on our perceptions.
Because the word truth is not a thing. Don't you understand? It's a label.
I understand that, Dan, but isn't that trivial?
But I don't think you're grasping here.
I mean, time is not a thing, right? Time is not a thing. When you say it's not a thing, can you and I agree, Dan Barker, that we're not talking about physical things?
Yes, I know.
We're talking about
can
a statement be an objective reflection of reality?
Yes, and I know exactly what you're saying, and I'm agreeing with you, but that is not my point. My point is that whatever truth, that label truth means, it is a defined thing within our species. We define what it means.
Dan, if you didn't exist, and if the human species didn't exist, right?
Yeah.
Would there still be either a God or no God?
There would not even be truth.
You should be able to say yes. You should be able to say, because human beings were not around eternally past, right?
Well, there is an objective reality. I think we should assume that we agree that there's an objective reality out there that's independent of what you and I
Amen. And let's say any statement that accurately represents that objective reality, let's say we call that truth.
Yeah, that's what I've been saying.
All right, good. Okay, so we've got past that hurdle. Now, regarding this empiricism that the only real knowledge comes through your five senses.
I didn't say that's the only real knowledge.
No, I know that you didn't, but there are people who argue that, right? Like the philosophy professor in the college class that I videotaped. Would you agree? Would you be able to tell those people, do a shout out to those folks and say, that's not valid, that the only real knowledge comes through your five senses? That's a cliche, but it's not valid. Would you agree with that?
I would say that real knowledge does come through our five senses, but additional information can come through coherency and reason and logic.
Absolutely.
Above and beyond, exactly.
Absolutely. Like, reason and logic are not part of your five senses. You can't sniff out whether an equation is true or not.
But they don't give you knowledge. They strengthen your claims. Because 2 plus 2 is 4, you still look at two apples on the table and two other apples, and you can empirically count that there are, in fact, not five apples there. There are four.
Right. So your senses are additional perspectives. And it seems like the more perspectives we could get into a matter, like if you have two or three witnesses, you've got a better chance of objectively determining what happened than if you only have one. That's why we don't convict somebody of murder on the testimony of one witness. So, yeah, I agree. Our five senses help to provide additional perspective to our reason.
There are more than five senses, by the way, but the five traditional senses are what we mostly rely on.
All right.
There's the sense of proprioception that we all have.
Yeah, that's
most of us don't think about that very much. I mean, we have internal senses that are not conscious to us.
Well, our consciousness, for example, the fact that we know we exist, when the curator, Kirk Johnson, I asked him in front of a reporter for the Colorado Springs Gazette, he wouldn't admit that there's truth. And I said, Kirk, do you exist? Do you exist? And he said he couldn't say for sure. And so that's where so often we're just beside ourselves trying to debate an atheist who can't admit some of these fundamentals so we could proceed.
But you can see he's got a point. If you're pressed up against the philosophical wall...
No, he doesn't have a point. He can't argue that he doesn't exist.
Well, I could argue the possibility that I don't exist, but I'm going
You could argue the possibility that I'm a dream, that you're having a dream right now, and that I don't exist. And this is what I meant earlier when I said, I sense that you're equivocating. I sense that you're equivocating on the most fundamental issue, and so it's hard to build from there any common ground. So you could argue that perhaps you're dreaming and I don't exist, but you cannot argue that you don't exist. You can't
yes,
do
I can.
That.
I could, but
I think
don't.
Therefore I am. I think therefore I am. For you to argue that you don't exist, Dan, is like an intellectual tantrum. And it's telling the audience, I'm so afraid of absolute truth that I can't even acknowledge without equivocation that I exist. So let
That's
me ask
silly.
You.
I don't go that far.
Well, we're 15 minutes in. Do you exist?
Yes, I do exist.
Okay, thank you. So then I could talk to you. If you didn't, I'd be in a quandary. Well, let me ask you about the universe, Dan Barker. And the universe...
It better be going somewhere.
Yeah, let me ask you about the universe, whether or not it had a beginning.
Well, that word... universe is defined in many different ways. If you mean
all the physical matter that exists,
everything,
the billions of galaxies, the billions of stars, the black holes, everything that exists.
Yeah, and including the entire cosmos.
Yeah,
beyond
cosmos.
Beyond, even above and beyond our own observable universe. If there are other universes, multiverses, and so on, most philosophers and scientists today are now calling that the cosmos. Because they realize that our own particular Big Bang, they're using the term universe in a more local sense. But yes, what was your question? Oh, did it have a beginning?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. Because to begin in time means, we know that time came into existence at the Big Bang. There was no before the Big Bang.
Well, I disagree with that, but...
Well, so do I. I mean, I disagree with you. I mean, time is a byproduct. Time is not something that exists eternally. Time only exists when matter and energy exist. So before matter and energy come into existence,
yeah,
in the Big Bang,
I disagree
no
with
time.
That definition of time. That's a byproduct of matter and energy. But Dan Barker, you know that Stephen Hawking addressed this explicitly in his writing, The Beginning of Time. I linked to it from our website. And he said that this argument about whether or not the universe had a beginning persisted into the 20th century. But he said, if the universe had no beginning, everything, this is a verbatim quote, everything would be at the same temperature, unquote. And he says that because energy is running down, entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, we know that the universe had a beginning. And he says that science has now come to an understanding that that must be, otherwise the whole universe would be cold and dead.
Okay, and you're right, and I've read his stuff. In fact, he sometimes has to correct himself later, but he's
but not on
that.
But Dan Barker, not on that.
Okay, but notice his important distinction. He didn't use the word cosmos there. He's talking about the word universe, as in our particular local
right.
Big Bang
so
universe.
For you to believe that there was that the universe didn't have a beginning, you have to posit that there are other universes. And I simply ask, did they have a beginning?
Well,
because they would have run out of usable energy before they ever got around to creating another universe.
See, I think that's a meaningless question. The word beginning implies causality within time. That's what the word beginning means.
It's not a meaningless question if you realize that there are actual atoms and molecules that make up our stars and our galaxies.
Not at the Big Bang there wasn't.
And
at the Big Bang.
Go ahead.
At the Big Bang itself, yeah. Whatever you want to call that moment, there were no particles. The laws of thermodynamics
That's
only
right.
apply to particles.
According to the atheist account of how the universe got here, the origin of the universe, the beginning was a violation of the known laws of physics. that if you take the laws of physics, that most atheists say that they build their worldview based on the scientific laws, they say, well, the way it got here, the Big Bang, of course it violated those laws, but we believe in that by faith.
No, that's not what we're saying.
Well, then how do you believe in a Big Bang that violates the laws of physics?
Because those laws of physics, for example, thermodynamics,
yeah,
only apply to particles. They only apply after you've
got
to a certain
they apply
point.
To energy, and energy is not particles. They,
yes, it
matter,
is.
We have matter and energy.
Energy,
and the laws
is,
of thermodynamics apply to energy.
They apply only to particles interacting with each other. The energy comes from the movement of particles. That's what we have, and their gravitational effect and their mass effect on each other. At a certain point in the Big Bang, there were no particles. There was no law to apply. There were no laws of thermodynamics to apply at that point. Those laws only come into existence, empirically.
Yeah, here's Stephen Hawking, in fact. He said there's like 10 to the 80th particles in the known universe. He said, where did those particles come from? He said, initially, there was a point like the North Pole. The North Pole is a point, but it's not a real thing. And he said it had no particles whatsoever in it, and it exploded and created the billions of stars and galaxies we have. And I submit that that is a belief, Dan Barker, not based on observable science or the laws of science or physics, but it's a belief based on faith. You have to accept that by faith. Would
you
agree, or could you tell us...
No, you can accept that as a tentative consensus conclusion that works for now among scientists who'd be happy to change their mind if there were better explanations in the future. That's not faith. That's what we're going with. No,
when you believe something that you don't have empirical evidence for, that's faith.
No, it isn't.
Faith is believing something that is not seen. Faith is looking at evidence. The New Testament says that faith is the evidence of things not seen.
Well, the New Testament is not the measure of science.
Well,
what scientists do,
concede for the purpose of this debate, I'll concede that point. But faith is the evidence of things not seen. You believe in something you can't see, the Big Bang.
No, that's wrong.
That's wrong. You don't believe in the Big Bang. Go ahead.
No, I don't believe in it. What scientists do, you're confusing faith with hypothesis. What scientists do is they have hypotheses, which are not statements of faith or of fact. They are statements of possibility, let's say, which can be confirmed or disconfirmed or strengthened or weakened. That is not faith, and that is not even knowledge. This is what we are going with. And maybe 100 years from now, scientists will say, oh, we were looking at it all wrong, but what else could we do with what we knew at the time? We're not making a leap of faith. I'm not claiming the Big Bang is some doctrine, atheistic doctrine. In fact, most Christians accept the fact of the Big Bang.
You just called it a fact when it violates the known laws of science, and there's no empirical evidence that it occurred. It is an assumption.
You should be able
to say, you know what, I can't prove it's a fact. Can you do that, Dan Barker? Could you say, I can't prove that the Big Bang is a fact?
I can't prove that it's a fact, and no scientist does claim that.
So could you take it back? A moment ago you said it was that most Christians believe in the fact of the Big Bang. Could you just take that back?
I might use a different word. They believe in the overwhelming consensus opinion of most cosmologists today.
Okay.
In the actual truth of the hypothesis of a Big Bang.
Okay, very good, very good. Thank you for that, Dan. And does consensus identify scientific truth? Is that how we know? Is it authority if enough people vote that the Earth is flat? Or
no, it's not vote. It's a peer review. It's
right,
it's
but let's say
testing.
Enough scientists believe that the sun revolves around the Earth. Is that what makes something true?
That makes something what we go with as truth.
Well,
we
if that were true, hey, Dan, if that were true, then the great scientists through the ages who challenged the status quo and dealt with a lot of persecution because of it, if they would have said the status quo is what we go with, they would have gone down a dead alley. The truth is out there, and quite often the majority is not consistent with the truth.
Well, that's exactly how I feel, especially about the majority religious opinion
in
this country.
All right. So that's right. The majority opinion does not establish the truth. Quite often the truth, it could be the opposite of what the majority believes.
But you do see at least how scientific consensus differs from religious faith, and that scientists are saying, here are our methods. Look at them. Test them for yourself. Prove us wrong. Here's how they can be falsified. Here's what would prove us wrong. And
Dan,
often, and the only way science improves is by more science,
hey, Dan,
not by faith.
Dan, I've been a Christian since 1973, so for 35 years. And what you just described is my faith for that 35 years. Prove me wrong. This is the methodology we use to arrive at our understanding of truth, of God's existence.
So you're talking about the resurrection.
I'm talking about all the evidence for the Creator God.
And I've looked at all that, and I'm not convinced by it.
Okay.
I've looked at it at least as closely as you have. In fact, I have an entire section in my new book minutely examining the resurrection claim that is so important. In fact, I used to preach that if Christ be not risen, our faith is
vain.
Yeah,
that is absolutely, that's absolutely true.
And I demonstrate convincingly to me and to lots of other people, including to a lot of believers, that the resurrection of Jesus, the bodily resurrection of Jesus, did not happen. It is a false
claim.
Why don't we
schedule a program on that topic?
Yeah, we should, because there's a lot to be learned. In fact, I'm surprised how little Christians actually know about this issue, which is one of their pivotal doctrines, and yet they know so little about it.
Yeah. Maybe what we should do is, I have a DVD on the resurrection of Jesus Christ, looking at the evidence. It's called Mount Moriah. And you have a book with a chapter. Maybe we should exchange those, view each other's arguments so we could save the audience time, and then dispute, then debate, then
figure out who's right.
I
think that would be quite informative. And I've done some debates. I've done about 65 debates, but I've only done about 5 or 6 of those on the resurrection itself.
All right. Well, when we're done, we'll get your address and we'll send you this DVD.
Well, that would be fun. That would
All right.
Be
now, let me ask you a question. Could we discuss a few more matters regarding to atheism? Do you have time to continue?
Well, our attorney's coming in about 20 minutes, so
okay.
We have time for that.
You want to take a few more minutes and continue a bit further?
Yeah, if we can go till about 20 minutes.
Okay, that sounds great. All right. The universe is presumably, according to the Big Bang, about 15 billion years old. And you've heard of the horizon problem, possibly. This has been known for decades by astrophysicists. The cosmic microwave background temperature of the universe, 2.7 degrees Kelvin, that when they measure it, it's so consistent to within about 1/1000th of a degree or so. And there is this horizon problem. It's actually a starlight and time problem. If the universe is only 15 billion years old, that's not nearly enough time by orders of magnitude for the background radiation temperature of the universe to even out so perfectly. And so when you hear an argument like that against the age of the universe, how do you respond? Do you consider that?
Yeah, I think there's still a lot to be learned. In fact, this whole idea of dark matter and the acceleration of the expansion, and of course, you know, they've mapped the inequalities in the cosmic background radiation. And by the way, they don't say 2.7 degrees Kelvin. They just say 2.7 Kelvin because the Kelvin is a degree.
Yeah.
But there's a lot to know. And there's a lot of mysteries. But the solution to those mysteries will be more science, and that's what drives science. Science is excited by the fact that there are these gaps and these big question marks. But to plug that gap with a personal God, that's really going way too far.
All right. So at least you can agree, and of course I could quote a dozen sources, that based on the presumed belief that that the universe is some billions of years old, there's not nearly enough time for the temperature of the universe to even out as perfectly as it's evened out. Let me ask you this. John Maddox, he was the editor of Nature magazine for 23 years. He wrote a book called What Remains to Be Discovered. And he said, which came first, stars or galaxies? This is on page 48 of his book. And he said, theoretical science offers no clear guidance. Dan Barker, many people I talk to, they've been convinced that the atheistic scientific community has figured out the Big Bang. They have it all figured out. And when I point out to them that they don't even know whether a star or a galaxy formed first. That shows the degree to which they're groping, that they really don't have it figured out.
Why is that a problem? Science admits that there's a lot we don't know.
Right. But if you figured out how the whole universe got here, you should have a pretty good grasp on how the galaxies formed, how the stars formed, how our solar system formed, the moon, right? And we spent about $20 billion on our Apollo programs, sent men to the moon, lunar landers.
But why is that a problem whether stars or galaxies were first? I mean,
it shows that we don't know how they formed. And if we don't know how stars and galaxies formed, then we have a footnote in our mind about the Big Bang, and we say, oh, it's not quite as clear as I was led to believe.
Well, yeah.
How about the moon, right? The theories that how the moon got there. Now, that's the closest thing to us, and we've been there a number of times. We should have the best grasp of everything in the universe, how the moon got there. Yet, what was it? Nature magazine a few years ago joked that the moon doesn't exist. It's observational error, because there are, you know, four or five opposing theories of how the moon got there. In each one, like the capture theory, the ejection theory, there's so many fundamental errors that there's no consensus. We don't know how the moon got there. Our own solar system, the gas giants, Jupiter and Saturn.
What's your point then? Because there are unanswered questions in science, we must believe in a God. Is that your point?
No, the point is that if we trust that the atheists have figured it out, how the Big Bang started our universe, we are putting a tremendous amount of trust in people who don't know most of what they're asserting.
Why are you saying that the atheists have figured out? Many of these scientists are believing Christians.
Well, some are, but it's the atheistic worldview that asserts that you have to describe everything apart from a creator.
But most Christians accept the fact that science can describe the natural world.
I accept that fact also, that science can't describe. So, Dan, like the evolution of the solar system. Recent quotes from major scientific publications saying that the models for how a solar system would evolve do not allow for gas giants like Jupiter and Saturn. It's totally befuddling that they're there. They should have been sucked into the sun.
So what's your point with all this? There are answers to be sought.
Well, that Isaac Newton was right. You know, Descartes thought that the solar system was formed by a gas nebula that was spiraling and condensed. And Isaac Newton, who helped us figure out physics, gravity, and color and gravity, Isaac Newton said, no, there's no place in my system of gravity for Descartes' notion. That would not happen. And here we are, hundreds of years later, and when we look at our solar system, we see evidence it could not have formed naturally. It just couldn't have. The gas giants wouldn't be there. The gravity of the sun, it's so enormous, it would have sucked them in. So isn't that evidence, Dan? The fact that they're there, isn't that evidence that we could consider, could this have formed naturally?
Well, it's hard to know where you're going with this. There are many questions that are not answered and many that eventually are answered in science.
I agree with that. But let me ask you this. Theoretically, could there be evidence that precludes some possibilities? Could there be evidence that shuts a door? Like if somebody thinks that, that something happened by, let's say, a biogenesis that flies develop from rotting carcasses. And so that was widely believed, that carcasses, as they decompose, new species of life arise out of them. So could there be evidence that closes that door and says, no, billions of times a year, new species don't arise out of carcasses. Could there be evidence that closed that door?
They could close the door to a hypothesis, but
yes,
that doesn't rule out other natural hypotheses.
Well, right, but it could close the door to that hypothesis. So
that particular one, yes.
So there's a hypothesis that our solar system was created as a nebula, condensed, spiraling nebula. But, Dan, you know that the sun has like 99% of the mass of the solar system, right? And the planets have about 1%. Yet the sun is hardly spinning at all compared to the planets. In fact, 99% of the angular momentum of our solar system is in the planets, and not in the sun. So if we just condensed, like Descartes thought, from a gas cloud, the sun should have 99%, almost all of the spin of the solar system. It has almost none. So as a creationist, we look at scientific evidence like that. That's hard scientific data. And we say that's evidence that the solar system did not condense from a gas cloud.
Why is that a problem?
I mean, because the sun isn't spinning.
It's like you're arguing
from... You have to stop the sun from spinning.
But the sun is not a solid object.
Yep, Dan, the...
The
maybe.
Sun is not solid. The sun is a plasma liquid thing.
Well,
obviously, its angular momentum.
The sun has measurable angular momentum, and it's 1% of the universe. And according to the law of the conservation of angular momentum, you could look this up later. I have that when spinning objects break apart, then that spin, the momentum of the spin, goes with those pieces that are broke off. So when the planets break off with 1%, if this was a spinning gas cloud, when the planets broke off, they should have 1% of the spin. The sun has 99% of the mass of the solar system. It should have almost all the spin. And the reverse is true. So, Dan, wouldn't you say this, even though you don't believe in God, wouldn't you say, okay, I'll put the angular momentum of the sun in the column against the solar system forming from a spinning gas cloud? Could you say that?
Well, I would say that's a possibility, but that doesn't rule out other natural explanations.
Oh, right. There might be. Right. There might be. Yeah, maybe, you know, there could be. Richard Dawkins in the movie Expelled, Ben Stein's movie, said the complexity of molecular biology might suggest that life on Earth was started by something out there. He said,
He doesn't really believe that. He threw that out as one crazy hypothesis.
Well, I watched. We had a movie marathon opening weekend, and we watched that. Members of American Right to Life watched that movie 18 times.
But have you seen Richard Dawkins' review of how he was misquoted?
I've seen that scene, Dan Barker, over and over. It's an extended discussion. It's calm. There's no edit cuts. And
yeah, but he admits that he was throwing out one of the possibilities.
Have you seen it?
Yes, I've seen it, but he doesn't believe that. Dawkins flatly says that is one of the possibilities, but he's not ascribing to that.
And you know what's
funny? You know that.
Dan, you know what's funny? All those scientists like, you know, discoverers of DNA and all Nobel laureates who say biological life is so complex, it couldn't have evolved on Earth. It had to come from aliens. And quite often, there's many, many atheists who subscribe to that. We can't quantify.
Francis Crick was one, but I don't know of any atheists.
There's many who believe this panspermia theory.
No, I don't think there are.
You could Google it and see how widely discussed it is.
That was one hypothesis that Francis Crick threw out, and that, I mean, we can't discount it, but nobody really thinks.
You know, it's funny, Dan. A lot of the people who do believe in that are also strong opponents of intelligent design. So if they believe life came from aliens, but they're against intelligent design, they must believe in stupid aliens. They must think that stupid aliens planted DNA on Earth.
What Dawkins' point is that if we were created by either aliens or by a god or whatever, from something outside of our planet,
it would have had to evolve.
It would have had to evolve itself.
Takes that on faith, because if biological life, if it's determined that encoding life into a DNA molecule is so complex that it requires an N number of steps to accomplish minimal functionality, and that could not happen by chance, if we determine that...
But we haven't.
If we did, say that, well, it couldn't happen here, but it happened out in space somewhere, that's just punting. Because if the laws of physics tell us it couldn't happen here, then why could it happen there? That's simply punting and blind faith.
Yeah, but the laws of physics don't tell us that. I mean, that is a if question, but there was plenty of time. Have you read Dawkins' book, Climbing Mount Improbable?
No, I've read a couple of his books.
Oh, you will love Climbing Mount Improbable, because he shows that the mistake a lot of creationists make is they think of it as this huge cliff that has to be leaped up to, and nobody would think it was even possible to go from here to there. But if you go back around behind it, you see this gradual increase
Yeah.
You could walk for miles and not even notice the increase, but eventually you get there.
You know, I'd love to email to you a drawing of an eye that we just did, of a muscle on the top of the eye, the superior oblique, and it's threaded through a sling called the trochlea. And, Dan, it's just the most extraordinary thing. It's the simplest aspect of the design of a human body, but I'd like to email that to you. I know that you need to go. And I'm thrilled with the idea of scheduling a discussion on the resurrection of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, because once we dismiss that, I think we can get beyond it and see Christianity as the mythology and the superstition that it really is, that there's a better way.
Yeah.
I used to preach it. I used to believe it. But you and I, and I know, Bob, you're a good person, and I think you're good in spite of Jesus. You're a good person in spite of the Bible.
Yeah,
you're too smart to follow those teachings, you know, to the letter. And I applaud you for that.
Well,
I'm complimenting you.
I realize your assertions are, as you've stated, Dan, but let's do that. We'll conclude this segment, and if you could hold on one moment, we'll get your mailing address, and we'll get that off to you.
Very good.
All right. Thank you, Dan Barker. Please call in to Bob Benyart Live, 1-800-8-NYART, 1-800-836-9278. By the way, for any new listener, if you've never ordered anything from us, we're happy to send you a Bible Tour of Israel DVD that we produce for free, 1-800-8-NYART. Maranatha, what a great school in Arvada, Maranatha.